Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. So great to have Rob Salkowitz back on the show on Word Balloon. Rob, of course, is the author of Comic-Con and the Business of Pop Culture. He writes coverage of the geek industry for Forbes.com, and he also does columns for ICV2.com. And that's where I saw his coverage of the outcry that came from the recent Marvel Retailer Summits. Last month, Marvel Comics held a two-day summit with comic shop retailers, and ICV2's editor and publisher Milton Greep was the lone reporter in the room, and he described the discussions this way. This was the first event of its kind since Marvel emerged from bankruptcy 20 years ago. The company elected to host the event as a way to gather information from the people on the front lines, to get feedback from retailers on its plans, and to communicate that it's hearing retailer concerns and engaging with them moving forward. The instructions to retailers were to say what you need to say with no holds barred, and he puts in his own editorial, not that we've ever known comic retailers to be sharing their opinions. Questions were gathered before the event and solicited throughout. Editorial staff, including Axel Alonso, Tom Brevoort, and others, participated in the discussions of content and made presentations on plans for upcoming initiatives. Among the editorial topics discussed were reboots and restarts, event fatigue, timing of events, political overtones in comics, and legacy characters versus new versions of characters. All subjects we've been hearing a lot about from retailers over the past months. Marketing staff participated in all the discussions and made a presentation on current and upcoming marketing plans. Response from the retailers in attendance was generally positive, both because Marvel was making an effort to communicate and gather input, but also because the content of the presentation, which were seen as promising signs of better sales after a tough start of the year. I absolutely recommend you go to ICV2 if you haven't already, and read Milton's coverage of the summit, but also his interview with David Gabriel, the vice president of marketing. He made a comment that broke the internet. Greep asked the question, things that had seemed to work in the past clearly didn't seem to work in that October-November period. He asked, did taste change and why did taste change? Gabriel's response was, I don't know if that's a question for me. I think that's a better question for retailers who are seeing all publishers. What we were heard was that people didn't want any more diversity. They didn't want female characters out there. That's what we heard. Whether we believe it or not, I don't think that's really true. But that's what we saw in sales. We saw the sales of any character that was diverse, any character that was new, our female characters, anything that was not a core Marvel character, people were turning their nose up against. That was difficult for us because we had a lot of fresh, new, exciting ideas that we were trying to get out, and nothing new really worked. Then Gabriel went out and has since corrected the statement, saying, discussed candidly by some of the retailers at the summit, we heard that some were not happy with the false abandonment of the core Marvel heroes, and contrary to what some said about characters not working, the sticking factor and popularity for a majority of these new titles and characters, like Squirrel Girl, Ms. Marvel, The Mighty Thor, Spider-Gwen, Miles Morales, and Moon Girl, continue to prove that our fans and retailers are excited about these new heroes. And let me be clear, our new heroes are not going anywhere. We're proud and excited to keep introducing unique characters that reflect new voices and new experiences into the Marvel Universe and pair them with our iconic heroes. We've also been hearing from stores that welcome and champion our new characters and titles and want more. They've invigorated their own customer base and helped them grow their stores because of it. So we're getting both sides of the story, and the only upcoming change we're making is to ensure we don't lose our focus of our core heroes. Complicated issue for all publishers and really all media companies that face this around the world. We saw the outrage over the Kendall Jenner Pepsi commercial. And I, you know, rolled my eyes at first, but then it's like, no, you know, I get it. I understand where the anger is coming from. And also, it's just very interesting to watch the power of the consumer to yell very loudly and say no and really get something done. You know, that's really interesting. So Rob Salkowitz really took a hard look at some of the general issues that were discussed in this Marvel Summit. And I think really analyze these in a very good way in terms of explaining the bigger stakes. It really isn't just a direct market question. It really is a global question, a global market question. And I am happy to have Rob on to talk about his two articles at ICV2, which I both think you should read, and also the chance to hear more about it in this conversation on today's Word Balloon. It's brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Come to InStockTrades.com now for some last chance sales from 50 to 90% on a lot of out of print titles. They also have great discounts on books that unfortunately might have scratches. And if you don't mind a little damaged thing, you're going to get a great deal from InStockTrades. Also, DC and Image titles currently a huge 45% off. So those are some of the general deals. Here's some of the specific books on sale this week at InStockTrades. There's Chew, hardcover volume 6. That's the final act of Chew. It's called Omnivore. John Layman, Rob Gilroy, the wonderful creators, 45% off. It's just $21.99. There's Green Arrow, trade paperback volume 2 in the Rebirth series. It's called Island of Scars. Ben Percy and Otto Schmidt, your creative team. The book is 45% off, $9.34. There's Boruto, graphic novel volume 1, The Naruto Next Generations. I am not going to name these creators, forgive me. But it's the next phase in Naruto, and it is 30% off, just $6.99. Some of the great deals that are happening at InStockTrades.com. If your orders are $50 or more, you receive free shipping. They're wonderful people to work with. You will find great books at great prices at InStockTrades.com. Word Balloon is also brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you, League, for your continued support via Patreon. More people have joined in the last couple days, and people have shifted their subscriptions. Thank you very much. Really do appreciate it. You're keeping the lights on for Word Balloon, and I thank you for that. League of Word Balloon listeners, if you would like to subscribe, do you think Word Balloon's content is worth the price of a comic a month? That would be great. If you could spare $5 a month, that would be wonderful. Wordballoon.com. If you go there and right on the front page, there's a Patreon ad. It will take you to my Patreon page, or you can go directly to patreon.com/wordballoon. Thanks again, League of Word Balloon listeners. All right, without further ado, I'm really happy to have Rob Salkowitz back because he is a really smart guy. You'll remember Rob is the author of Comic-Con and the Business of Pop Culture. We've talked about that book several times in past Word Balloons, and Rob has been on to give his view on the geek industry and what's going on, various trends, and this seemed like an opportunity to talk to him and get clarification on, again, the bigger picture of what all this means, the things that are being discussed as a result of this Marvel Retailer Summit. Let's talk to Rob now on Word Balloon. He's back, and I'm really glad because when a complicated issue comes up, I like to hear from analysts who bring nuance to their account of what's going on and their interpretation. And clearly Rob Salkowitz is a guy like that. He wrote two excellent columns at ICV2 about the Marvel Retailer Summit, the fallout from it, and I think really understands the market and the consumers. So, Rob, welcome back to Word Balloon.
A pleasure to be on, as always, John.
You know, this was a meeting between Marvel and retailers. Milton Greep was allowed to cover it and gave an account of it, and also had a private interview with David Gabriel as well. Everyone is getting their source material from that content. But again, I think they kind of – it's a lot more complicated than just, I think, what he said, how it was understood, and also, you know, the positions of both DC and Marvel. You know, they're like McDonald's and Burger King. And I'm not saying to diversify their menus and serve as many consumers as they can and stuff like that. I also think that it's just more complicated. And again, I'm not trying to take them off the hook. I just think that this is they're catering to different markets and different consumers in different markets. And I think your columns talk about that. So if you would, there's no question there. Yeah. But yeah, what do you think? You know, talk about the problem. And you know, we'll talk about possible solutions, I guess.
Yeah, so when I read what Milton had reported on the Retailer Summit and I saw what Gabriel had said, I just kind of shook my head because I thought this poor guy just went wandering off into a minefield, and it's the wrong minefield. Because as soon as you start talking about this stuff about diversity and attempts to diversify the audience, you're immediately going to divide people up into the pro and con sides of that around a discussion that really has very little to do with the business side of it. Gabriel is a sales and marketing guy. His job is to move units to keep the retailers happy because the retailers are really the customers for the product in the direct market. And he was characterizing, I think, what he had heard from retailers not necessarily Marvel's strategy or Marvel's view of the world, but the minute those words were out of his mouth, we're sort of off to the races on the culture war side of things, yes, which is not really where the conversation needed to go. Because the bigger problem for Marvel and for DC as well is the audience for comic-based content is getting larger. And you can see that because of all the people that go to the movies, all the people that show up at conventions and yep, events, and all of these other aspects of fandom that by every way that we can measure it is gender diverse, ethnically diverse, age diverse, all of that stuff.
You bet.
The one place that isn't is the direct market, is the comic book stores. And they're getting a lot better, and especially the comic stores in urban areas, our stores in Chicago and Seattle and LA and stuff, yes, like that. There's plenty of stores that cater to an extremely wide variety of customers and keep a lot of cool stuff on the shelves to make everybody happy. But then there's like a huge amount of the market that serves the same guys that have been coming in and out of that store for the last 20, 25 years. And they come for their DC and Marvel. That's the bread and butter,
yeah,
for those retailers. They want what they want. They have a huge investment in the continuity and the legacy characters. They don't like it when the publishers mess with this stuff in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go back 20 years and look at, Kyle Rayner and, all of,
yes,
the – like it doesn't have to be a diversity issue to get fans pissed off about, messing with who's behind the mask.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, yeah. I'm really glad you brought up Kyle Rayner, because that and Connor Hawk, for that matter. Yeah, those thoughts crossed my mind. It's exactly the same problem. You've taken the legacy or the hero. I heard Heidi say the same thing. Which one is the legacy? Is it the historic character or the new character? But you take the established historic character off the board. You replace it with new characters, and some people get really excited. But, we all know our Hal Jordan lovers that were really, really pissed. And then conversely, Wally West is the standard for 25 years. Barry Allen is back, and you've got a lot of old Wally West fans that are mad for a really long time. But continue.
Yeah. I mean, in the 90s, the imperative on the publisher side seemed to be, we've had the same fans since the 60s and 70s, and there's like a new generation. So we're trying to make everybody a little bit younger so that we don't have like characters with gray hair in their temples and that, sure, sort of stuff. And now it's a better kind of diversity, a broader kind of diversity.
No question.
And so they, it's like I applaud the, they're doing the right thing because they see these customers out there and they're trying to make the connection between all of the people wearing the merchandise and going to the movies, trying to get those people into the comic shops with characters that appeal to them.
Yep.
But the comic shop is a tough nut for that. And so it's kind of at cross purposes. But so the first article I wrote was sort of looking at the direct market angle of that, mm-hmm, and recognizing that especially DC and Marvel have a huge problem because their product keeps the retail channel afloat. You ask any retailer, 70-80% of their sales are big two. So if something goes wrong with that, if an event goes wrong, if a character flops, if something happens, the stores suffer. And if enough stores go out of business, then the publishers are going to suffer from that, and the whole market is going to suffer.
Yes.
So it's like they have a responsibility to keep those guys in business, however they can. The publishers do.
Yes. Agreed. No, as you said, they're the direct customers. They're the ones really buying the non-returnable merchandise. And, it's tough. I mean, if you've got stores saying no to a specific product, then, you have to decide what other channels are there. But I know that Marvel in particular, even more so, I think, than DC. DC seems to always be willing to at least go 12 issues before they cancel a book. If Marvel's sales are low, they'll cut it off, whatever story arc is going on. And in a lot of cases, announced ongoing books suddenly become a 5-issue miniseries because they've been canceled because of low sales after the first issue.
Well, this is the other problem that Gabriel didn't address this very well, but from what I've heard from retailers is that their bigger problem is the restarting of all the series at number one, and existing customers don't like that. They don't They don't know where to come back on. They don't like picking up a number one issue that might as well just be a continuation of the previous series. Sure. Like, there's a lot of garbage with variant covers that's sucking a lot of money out of the market. So there's plenty of stuff to complain about, and it was, again, unfortunate that he fixated on that one, because there's plenty of problems to go around. But then if you look at the other side, I mean, the real contrast here is if you look on the bookstore side.
Yes.
And that's where diversity lives. And the biggest selling, you know, comic person in the universe right now is Raina Teggelmeyer. I'm sorry, am I saying that right?
That's how I've always heard it, but go ahead.
Yes. So, but you know who I mean.
Yes.
And, you know, and she's, you know, anybody with a daughter, you know, aged, you know, 9 to 12 – she owns that market. She's got 7 or 8 titles in the bestseller list. She's outselling the big guns, you know, of the direct market side, you know, 5 or 6 to 1 at least. And so she, you know, the publishers that are able to go directly into the book market can capture that diversity in ways that the comic market can't. But DC and Marvel rely – they don't do original graphic novels that much. They'll collect the stuff in trade. And so it has to sell and be put out one issue at a time and sell through the direct market before they put the trade together and can reach the bookstore. So it's kind of a – that's kind of a business problem for them as well, I think.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's they always say that every facet of publishing, from floppy magazine to the digital product to the trade – and then, you know, hardcover and whatever possible further exploited versions can happen and stuff are necessary. But yeah, if, you know, if something doesn't work, I guess, in one of those channels, I think they immediately say not cost effective, and they move away from their books. Because you'd think that there's got to be an answer in terms of, if something doesn't sell in the direct market, all right, well, how can we, you know, they have done it. I know that the Stephen King adaptations were really made primarily for the book market, you know, the book selling market and stuff. I don't know. I know that, again, I know that the budgets for each individual book are very carefully considered. And, you know, Gabriel is that kind of numbers cruncher that really does say, all right, we can spend, you know, I'm just going to throw out hypothetical numbers, $10,000 per month on a book because it's going to make us, you know, 20. And it's, you know, it's worth us doing. If it falls below that profit margin, we're not going to do it. And again, these are all hypothetical numbers. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I just don't understand why that's not pursued more. Or as far as the numbering concern from stores, I've never heard a store ask the direct question, can't you just call it Spider-Man, The Vulture's Revenge, 1 through 6? And then the next one, Spider-Man, Hammerhead is Back, 1 through 6. And that should, you know, kind of solve the problem of, all right, you know, every 6 months you're going to have a new number one. And it's clear what it is in regards to. And people can see on the stands, oh, all right, that's, you know, chapter 2 of a 6-part, you know, story or something. They do it inside the book. But you'd think they'd do it on the cover.
Well, some of the other publishers have had some success doing this sort of season concept. It never seems to have caught on that much with DC and Marvel. I mean, I know Dark Horse does it, you know, like with the Buffy books and with things like that. And that's a framework that people understand.
Sure.
But to me, the bigger problem is that the huge disparity that apparently exists between the direct market audience and the outside world. And the fact that these guys are kind of getting caught, you know, on, with one foot on each, and they're sort of drifting apart, and they can't quit either one of them because they're both important. And what I compared the direct market to was on Twitter, and somebody was asking me about this, and I said it's like the that plant in the Alan Moore Superman story. I think it's called Black Mercy Plant.
Yes.
That sort of sits on your face and feeds you happy talk as it strangles the life out of you.
Your lifelong dreams are fulfilled. So yes, are you saying the direct market people, or are you saying DC and Marvel live in a world of that kind of fantasy world, or are trying to live in that kind of fantasy world?
I'm saying that they're kind of stuck in it because they've got the direct market stuck to their face. They can't like rip it off or they'll die. And the direct market is feeding them a twisted, distorted version of reality that they have to react to.
Okay,
and,
I'm with you.
Yeah, and that doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in the real world. And the longer they succumb to that, the more they are strangling themselves.
Yeah, well,
and
they're dependent.
And the more inert they become.
Yeah. Yeah, they're dependent on it, and yeah, they're stuck. They're stuck doing the same thing. I hear you, man. I understand that. And you know, seriously, this I'm sure very much might sound like white middle-aged guy, you know, not quite getting why there isn't room for both, and that maybe again, it's easy for me to say it's not my money, but it would seem that if they want to, you know, continue to, you know, do diverse products and stuff, I think that's great. They have to give more time for that stuff to develop an audience, a much more diverse audience, and you talk about that as well. That in some stores it might really be just DC and Marvel in their stores, but in a lot of stores, and certainly in the big cities and stuff, they are competing with so many other publishers that are, on the one hand, doing, you know, some, I like your rundown of it, so I'm going to let you describe, you know, obviously the different kind of publishers that are out there and what they're putting in the direct market in competition with DC and Marvel.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of good stuff out there. It's not like there's a shortage of great comics, rather the opposite. And one of the things that I worry about is that even if you take the focus off of Marvel or off of, you know, the big two, mm-hmm. and you look at, okay, so I'm not a superhero customer, so what does, you know, Image and Dark Horse and IDW and Boom and down the line have for me? Well, it's more and more stuff, and it's all good.
Yeah.
I have a limited budget, and especially if I'm 20% of the market as a non-superhero reader, you know – and even, you know, Image has like 12 great books and they all are having these continuing stories and you need to, you know, keep track of all of them.
Yes.
Eventually the reader's budget runs out and some of these things might be better off paced out over a longer period so that you don't use up the market right away on all of your good stuff, or you don't set your creators against each other in sort of a Hunger Games, you know, to see whose great idea is going to win out.
Yeah, I hear that. That's true too. You know, I talked to Bendis. I haven't released the word balloon yet, but Bendis made a good point. He wonders if, especially for DC and Marvel, as the television shows continue and stuff, does it hurt what was a reader, you know, or would a potential would-be reader, they're getting, you know, 20, 22 Flash stories a year. And some of these, other, you know, obviously with the other television shows, weekly television shows, that might, you know, sate them enough that they won't come in the store. Not only converting new customers and stuff, but even old customers who might be like, yeah, you know, I used to buy the Flash, but now I get it every week. I don't need to go in the, you know, store and wait 30 days for the next chapter in the same story.
Yeah, and this is why I'm curious. I mean, a couple of years ago when I wrote the Comic-Con and Business of Pop Culture book, there was this idea that was sort of floating around called transmedia, which is this idea that you would have your big universe and you would tell some of the same story in TV shows, movies, comics, video games, and that it wouldn't just be the same characters in, you know, adapting the situations from one medium to another. It would actually be, you know, and IDW did this pretty well with the Star Trek stuff when the first Star Trek movie came out, the Abrams reboot. Mm-hmm. And IDW did a four-issue storyline that told some of the backstory. You could read the issues and not see the movie and you get a story, or you could see the movie and not read the issues and you get a story.
Yep.
But if you read the issues and watched the movie, you would get the whole story.
Yep. Absolutely. No, I read that prequel. I thought that was pretty good. It was Spock's motivations with the Romulans before the movie starts, and it's this great, you know, prequel to the movie, and it was fantastic. I agree with you. Yeah, that's a different.
And now that these shows have such a big footprint, and you know, you've got the DC universe that has continuity within itself inside the TV shows, would it be that hard to have, you know, a set of titles that cater just to those viewers, mm-hmm. that has like backstory that follows up on some of the characters that we haven't been seeing very often, or that tells some of the Rip Hunter backstory on Legends of Tomorrow, or, you know, just those kind of things that that take advantage of the people that are on that one platform primarily, but still want some more story.
Yeah, and they have. I know digitally, you know, Flash Season Zero, yes. and they have done Legends of Tomorrow kind of special books, and certainly Smallville almost taking the Buffy model and continuing the Smallville you know, universe through comics and stuff. I think all of that was really smart and really effective. You know,
that's true. DC does it digitally, but unfortunately, digitally doesn't bring the customers into the store.
Well, that's true. No, you're right about that. So I guess that doesn't help the direct market. They do have the eventual magazine that, you know, collects yep. what is released digitally every week and everything. You know, Batman 66 was a good example of that.
Oh yeah, the great series.
Yeah.
But interestingly, one of the things that happened when I wrote the first piece for ICV2, and mm-hmm. ICV2 now has a premium section that's in beta, and they have like a few people on there. So usually on ICV2 there's no comments on the posts, but now they have a forum where people comment. So a retailer from South Carolina, I think his name is Daniel Maccabee, wrote this really interesting response to my piece, and he says, "This is the stupidest problem. Why is it one or the other? Yes. Why do you have that diversity, or you mess with old characters, or you don't have diversity and you keep the old characters the same? Why not just create diverse characters?" And I thought, that seems like an easy answer. And then when you go and look at it, I mean, can we think of a corporate-owned character at DC or Marvel that's been created in the last 25 years of note?
Well, you actually do put out some, and especially in the case of DC, where they're taking old names and creating new characters with them and stuff. And a character
that's not a reboot, because they own the trademark to them. So if they hire a creative team to come in and breathe life into, you know, hesitate to even say the name Mr. Terrific because it's such a stupid superhero name. I like Mr. Terrific too. I think they made a great character out of him, but it's unfortunate that it was like some corny concept from 1940 that they had to reskin, because if they had come up with a different name and trademark for that character, then they would have opened up some creator rights problems.
You make a very specific point of that happened with DC and Vertigo. In the case of an original comic called Gravedigger.
Yeah, so I was at WonderCon last week, and I was moderating – Chris Robertson was a guest of honor at the mm-hmm. show, so I was moderating his spotlight panel, and we were talking about this. And I asked him about the genesis of iZombie, and he said that the original pitch for that was this character called Gravedigger, and he was kind of toying around with this idea about zombies and why – if you were a zombie, wouldn't you be in some line of work where you had access to dead bodies? And so he – like that was his original thinking with uh-huh. it. And then he's going to do the Gravedigger concept for Vertigo, because Vertigo was specializing in those kind of reskins. They got Mike Allred as the artist, and Mike says, "I'd love to work with Chris. I'd love to do this book, but I don't want to work on a corporate-owned book. I want creator-owned if we can do it." And DC apparently said, well, there's two things you can do. We can license you the trademark so that you'll have the copyright and the creative rights to everything that you do with that, or we can just create a new character and spin it off and just make it its own thing, and then you would have ownership of that. And Chris was like, okay, we'll take the latter, because that seemed easier all around. And that worked out well for them. But, you know, when I think people were shooting me ideas. So Runaways, I think, mm-hmm. was a corporate owned new concept that Marvel owns, that Vaughn created. And Winter Soldier is a new character that Brubaker created, right. And I think it's possible he participates in that. But Bucky Barnes was an existing character in Marvel, so right. It's like, it's hard to say.
Joe Simon, Jack Kirby, in that case, those are the creators. And then in another example that you just described in explaining the creation of iZombie, everyone knows that Watchmen started as a concept for the recently bought Charlton superheroes when DC bought those. And certainly Gibbons and Moore thought that eventually they would retain the creator rights. After a while, it would go out of print and that they would get them. Obviously, Watchmen has never gone out of print, and that's kind of the cautionary tale that was work for hire for the publishers from literally day one. You know, I mean, God, we've all seen the $190 check that Siegel and Schuster got for creating Superman. You know, it's rough. And for decades, it's like the record companies. For decades, they did things a certain way. Then the market changed, and record companies aren't in business the way that they used to be. And if they still even exist, so few do now, And maybe comics is going through this kind of growing pain from a creator standpoint, but also this new diverse market that might be asking for more than what they can deliver.
Well, I mean, and in fairness to the publishers, you know, to DC and Marvel on this, that there is a real – there's a strong business case to be made for why you need to own your core IP. And
sure,
you can't be sharing those rights with a whole bunch of creators, because when stuff gets licensed or when movies get made or whenever all of this stuff happens, fewer people at the table makes it easier to get those deals done. And you know, these are corporations with responsibilities to their shareholders and – all of that stuff. So I think they look at it, and also for every one character that breaks out, maybe there's 10 that don't, that they assume the risk for.
Yes. No question.
Right? So it's not like they ask for the creator's money back if a creation doesn't work out, but then the creator comes by and says, wow, this thing made $1 million. Like, cut me in on it. And so I, you know, again, this is sort of devil's advocate,
sure,
to be sure.
Well, that's really, I think the whole point of this discussion is kind of to point out the devil's advocate points, but go on.
So, you know, so on one hand, there's reasons for doing what they do. They're not just plain evil, you know, full
sure.
stop. But on the other hand, they're in a creative business, and creation doesn't happen without a creator.
Absolutely.
And so if you make a business decision to say, we're taking a hard line on creators when it comes to our core IP properties, if you create something on a work-for-hire situation that's a character in the Marvel or DC universe, that belongs to us, and maybe we'll be nice about it and cut you in, as DC did when Paul Levitz was in charge, but it was not a formal arrangement. It's not an admission of shared ownership or anything like that. It's just depending on the disposition of the people in charge. Then any creator is going to say, fine, you're paying me to write a good story about your characters and sell a lot of books, which I will do. But when I have my own idea, I'm going to go somewhere else with it.
That's right. No, and I mean, you mentioned Mike Allred, and there are a lot of very well-established creators that probably you won't ever see do any DC or Marvel work, or if they do, it'll be in a very small, you know, kind of event style circumstance. And that makes sense. Because again, the market is now big enough to let these people take their names and create their own stuff and succeed or fail on, you know, the concept's own merit. I also think it's important to point out that while Marvel said this about, you know, or got this feedback, again, we should say it properly, from certain direct market retailers, they are standing behind these diverse characters. And I think DC is too. I mean, you are seeing Ms. Marvel show up in the animated shows. And certainly that is a much wider audience than the Wednesday Warriors or even the bookgoers, you know, reading audience and stuff.
Well, I think Ms. Marvel is a special case because, the one piece of thing of writing on all of this that I would recommend everybody read is Willow Wilson's response to this whole situation. She wrote a post on her Tumblr that I referred to in my piece because I thought it was just very well argued and talking about how, you know, like some of this stuff happens just through the natural creative process, and that's where Ms. Marvel came from. And the fact that it was organic and it wasn't forced and nobody knew what would happen with it, whereas some of this other stuff seems a little bit over-engineered and it might be just a bad idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not be the diversity of the character. It might just be that it's not a great story, or it wasn't, you know, timing was wrong, or they tried to make this character happen. I mean, in my opinion, like, I think it's freshening up these characters every once in a while is a good idea, and it opens up some new story possibilities when it's not the same old guy that's been, you know, Iron Man for the last 50 years. You know, I mean, try something different.
No, I agree. I also think, too, timing is an important thing because you're throwing all these movies and cartoons out there that reflect that Marvel Cinematic Universe version of Iron Man, and I do think people, you know, it re-energizes the old fans to say, oh, I want to read new Tony Stark stories. And even possibly the person that goes to see the film wants to see Tony Stark. And, you know, hey, Riri Williams is a great idea, and it's a very fun story, and it really is good. But I think the solution that the retailer suggested, too, is it doesn't need to be either or. It really – you need to find solutions, especially early on, to keep, you know, both versions around. I think Jason Aaron actually is doing a really effective job of that in Thor. We're following Jane Foster as Thor, And but the Odinson, I have to put my geek voice on when I say that name. But I do. I think it's now the Odinson is in a much more fascinating place, because if he's not Thor, who is he? And I think that's a really interesting character journey. And also, I think, again, timing, try not to do everything at once, because, God, it reminded me, and I used this example when I was talking to Bendis about when James Robinson, and also and now I'm blanking, shame on me, the great Justice League animated writer that passed away a couple years ago, wonderful writer.
Dwayne
McDuffie, thank you. You know, first James comes on to do Justice League, and it's like, oh, well, by the way, you can't get Superman and Wonder Woman because Straczynski's rebooting them and Superman's walking across the country. And Batman's stuck in time, so you can't – or, you know, he's out of the time stream, so you can't use him. And then poor Dwayne comes on, and it's like, hey, I want to do a Justice League, you know, book. You know, all I've done is made five seasons of amazing 20-minute Justice League stories. Certainly this is the guy to write Justice League. And it's like, well, who do I have? Well, we can give you Zatanna and Plastic Man and you know, like all the C-level Justice Leaguers. Well, maybe Hawkman? No, you can't have Hawkman. How about the Atom? No, you can't have the Atom. It's like, well, Jesus, what kind of hand are you giving this poker player to play with, man? I mean, it's ridiculous. So I think, yeah, I really think this generation's event that they're doing, and it really is, you know, basically the annuals for the summer. That's what they are. You know, I think that's a step in the right direction. But again, the stories are too slow. And so it is tough to, you know, when you're only telling two stories a year about and change, I think it's a lot harder to, you know, if you got an interesting concept, sometimes it feels like it goes on too long. I mean, Jane Foster has been Thor now for 5 years. That's pretty incredible when you think about it and stuff. And, you know, again, it's like a great story. And if you intend to keep her as Thor, that's fine. And now finally we're getting to the point where the Odinson, 5 years later, might be picking up a hammer soon. So, you know, it's interesting.
It is. And I think that, you know, that raises the other issue that's kind of behind all of this, which is, you know, is the value for dollars still there for the fans?
Yep.
At the pace of the story, I mean, how much does it cost to get the whole story relative to your other kinds of entertainment? You know, how long do these things take to read? Are they still collectible? You know, I mean, there's all of these other things looming in the background on the direct market. And again, I felt like it was sort of unfortunate to focus on this one thing that is at the worst is a mixed blessing. It's like, okay, you're turning some people off, but some people like the stories. Some old fans like the stories. Maybe you'll bring some new fans in. So, you know, like the diversity thing cuts both ways, even in the direct market. But some of this other stuff doesn't. Like, you know, if people are pissed off about the universe constantly churning, about overlong events, mm-hmm. about, you know, bad value for dollar in the books, about unstable creative teams, and the fact that you don't, you know, a lot of these projects don't allow enough time to gel, so, you know, and then they pull the rug out and they bring somebody else in and things like that. Those are a different order of problem than you know, what they're doing with the characters.
And it contributes again to that lower bottom dollar or that lower profit margin that you know, they saw in the fall and felt like it was necessary to talk about. You're right. It's interesting that they didn't talk about some of the obvious stuff. You know, the number one book last month was 75th issue of Spider-Man for $9.99. And it was really interesting because on the one hand, you might see that number and think, oh, well, you know, maybe as much, you know, personally, I'm like, really, $10 for a floppy book? I'm kind of not happy about that. And, you know, I but yet it was the number one book. So it's like, oh, maybe I was wrong. Yet I went into a few stores. And again, this is anecdotally, so I guess there's no real scientific measurement behind this. But it was interesting to hear the retailers say, yeah, we stocked the book. And it sold okay, but yeah, we still got issues and stuff. And it's like, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe the stores were willing to do it thinking that because it's got that kind of 75th number that it will be of interest and everything and it'll be a hot book. But again, like we said, they mess with the numbering so much. A 75th number of Spider-Man, what does that mean? The book's been around for over 700 issues. I mean, it's why, you know, it may be 800 now. I lose count. Because of the renumbering and stuff, the numbers are meaningless, and I don't even know from a collector's standpoint how the numbers still matter, the issue numbers.
Well, it's unclear to me how anything on the collector's side still matters, to tell you the truth. I mean, this whole business on the variant covers and everything,
yes.
I mean, this just escapes me. And, you know, like I see stuff going, you know, on eBay for certain amount of money. But I'm just wondering who's spending that money. What do they think they're getting? It's very odd to me, because back in the old days, there was a real case to be made for, you know, scarcity, or if there was distribution problems with a certain issue, or the fact that some of this stuff you couldn't count on it ever being reprinted. So if you wanted that part of the story, you had to go down and you had to go and track down the particular books.
That's right.
You know, and there wasn't a million places to get them. Now I feel like there's no comic I can't get with, you know, 10 seconds of a search and a click of a mouse. So without scarcity, where is collectability?
I agree.
Without even the thrill of the chase, and, you know, like going through 1,000 white boxes and pulling out, oh my gosh, I've been looking for this for 10 years, you know. Without even that aspect of it, like, what are we in this for, except just keeping stuff in our basement? So
you're 100% right, man. There are so many weeks where I miss the hot book and, oh, I'm sorry, it's sold out. It's like, all right, I just wanted to read it anyway, so I'll go on Comixology, or I'll go on Marvel, and, you know, or whatever publisher, and buy the digital copy, and I'm fine with that. I mean, back in my mind, I'm like, all right, I'm only, you know, I'm paying full price for a digital issue instead of a physical comic book. But again, it's one less comic book that's messing up my basement. So there's that.
Speaking of hot books, if I may change the subject for a second.
No, I'm always happy to talk to you. Please.
So I'm teaching this class at University of Washington. I teach it every spring on sort of comics as media, and I try and get good guest speakers to come in and talk to the students about different aspects of it. So a few months ago, I discovered this absolutely sensational new graphic novel called My Favorite Thing is Monsters.
Yes, from Chicago.
Chicago.
Yeah, the creator's from Chicago. Go on, please.
Yeah, her name is Emile Ferris, and not only is this her first graphic novel, it is her first published work in comics of any kind. And it is a masterpiece. It's instantly one of the five best graphic novels I have ever read. Like, so it's astonishing. It's really good. So it's from Fantagraphics, and there's this whole backstory about, like, the original shipment was lost at sea because it was coming over from Korea on a shipping company that went broke and all this stuff. So they finally got the copies over here, and all of the people like me who had been sitting on our review copies for 6 months waiting to let fly with all the praise for this book, like, the skies opened. You know, me and Forbes and New Yorker and Vulture and New York Times.
Fresh air on NPR.
Fresh air on NPR, like, just flooding the zone, like, oh, you got to read this book. Well, they sold out and the new ones aren't in yet. So I was going to assign this book to my students to read, because we have Emile speaking to the class 2 weeks from now. So I thought, you should go and read her book. You can't find a copy. You go on eBay and you look for this $300 and $400 for a copy of this book.
That's
the book's
fantastic.
The book hasn't even been out for a month.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah, it's so hopefully when the new ones arrive, the demand for those first will abate a little bit. But in the meantime, there's lots of people out there that want to read that book that are going to have a hard time. And at those prices, they'll have a hard time keeping it on the shelves in libraries too.
Understood. I wonder if she's going to C2E2. I hope she is. I mean, she is local, and it would make sense. It's a no-brainer, but I'm honestly not sure. I don't think I wasn't sure if I saw her name on the guest list. I'm gonna have to talk to Mike Nagin and see if that's happening.
She's very new to this world, you know. I mean, she comes out of a fine arts background. She has a very unusual personal story, you know, I think she had no idea. She was like, "Boy, I hope people like my book."
Sure.
Like, I was like, "Don't worry. People are gonna like your book."
Yeah, that's honestly what a great and her story is very much part of the book itself. So yeah, like, really, you know, when the book becomes available again, is it available digitally? Did Fantagraphics do a digital version of the book?
There may be a digital version of the book, although this is one that you want because it's a nice edition. But the thing is, I was over at the Fantagraphics offices in January, and they handed me a review copy, which was one of the several hundred that was flown over that wasn't on the ship.
Right.
So all the stuff that's in the market right now is kind of a I guess it's the real first edition from a trade perspective, but there's still a few hundred copies of the true first, which is the from that original print run.
A few copies, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like that's a collector's item. Like that, I don't know about it kind of variant cover, but if you've got a best-selling book and there's only 100 copies of the true first edition that exist because of this freak accident, that's what creates great collectability.
No question, it'll be interesting to see if that Like a Mouse from Art Spiegelman crosses over enough to the entire comic buying market where something that will be regarded with the value that it deserves. It'll be interesting to see. That's honestly, Rob, I know as an analyst, and you do, you know, we've said this before when talking about your books or other issues, that you analyze trends all the time. And I'm glad that your interest in geek culture has allowed you to do this in this environment, because and I'm sure you agree, this is the most interesting period since really the advent of the direct market, where things are really changing. And we're watching things change all the time, not only from a creator and publisher standpoint, but truly the audience having a very, very loud voice, as evidenced by what happened with Marvel, as evidenced by what happened with Kendall Jenner in that stupid Pepsi commercial. It's a really interesting time.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's – and the best thing about it is that the – you know, back in the old days, there was comics, you know, because the whole market would fit in a – you know, in the San Diego Convention Center basically. And now – so you had, you know, like the art alternative comics – next to the superhero comics, and it was all kind of in the same thing. Now, comics as art and literature is going in one direction and getting all of this sort of cultural recognition, and there's also the whole pop culture industry that makes what DC and Marvel are doing almost a separate business from what the other guys are in. So you can watch it from whatever direction you want. And, you know, what's true on the art and literature and, you know, the larger non-direct market side of comics, you can say a whole bunch of stuff that is interesting and true that doesn't apply to superheroes and vice versa. And that's kind of the bind that Gabriel was in, because the world that they're seeing at Marvel and the world of comics culture in general are not – they don't overlap as much as they used to.
Yeah, you know, John Hickman said it a couple years ago on my show. The books might be on the same shelf in the comic store, but they're there for different reasons. And I thought,
well said.
John Hickman, there you go. The guy can turn a phrase. No, and again, my food analogy. I mean, it's the, you know, difference between gastropubs and foodies going and finding the great new places to go. And, you know, Marvel, McDonald's and Burger King keep chugging along and making hamburgers for people and making a very specific product that, you know, it's food, but it's food of a different kind. Sort of.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, it is interesting watching this internet audience react. We saw the reaction, all the Iron Fist controversy. And it, you know what, I've never heard anyone say, in defense of the character of Iron Fist, the partnership with Luke Cage, that used to be a celebration of social justice. That really was of its time hey, these two races can work together and actually be brothers. And it was, I really think that was one of the great messages of Power Man and Iron Fist. And, you know, I haven't heard that comment made in this debate of whether Iron Fist should be rebooted, you know, as an Asian character, or maybe even disregarded completely because of white appropriation.
Yeah, the Iron Fist thing, I haven't seen the show. I've sort of kept one eye on that, but the one that was interesting to me is Ghost in the Shell.
Yes.
So I was just looking at the box office numbers for that, and that film is nowhere. Like it is tanking tremendously. And what it occurred to me is that whenever these people in Hollywood, you know, reject diversity, their line is, oh, we're not being racist, you know, even though we sound racist. We're acknowledging the business realities of the industry, and you guys have to respect that. And it's like, well, if that film makes $500 million, then we can have that conversation. And, you know, all right, Scarlett Johansson can open a movie. Tell me how having an Asian cast would have made that film do any worse than it did.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I hope that they remember this and that the objections of the people that the people had against that movie aren't forgotten, because it may be the case that the bad press hurt the box office, but, you know, it might have been bad decisions by Hollywood that did it. And again, like, you know, sort of banking on this idea that having, you know, a white star, honestly, to open your movie is going to be the ticket to success. They need to revisit that assumption, because that does not appear to be correct in this case.
Yeah, I'll be interested if the production happens and we do get a movie. They're talking about maybe Jordan Peele doing Akira. And I don't know how concrete that is, but, you know, something that I know I've read in the last few weeks. And I would love to see it. I'll be interested to see how it's cast and how it's received. And the other thing that I'm really looking forward to is when Valiant finally gets into the movie business. And I know that they're nudging towards – aren't they nudging towards both film and streaming TV?
They are, and they don't talk about it very much. I have great respect for that company. They really they don't get over their skis, you know. They have like, I don't know, 8 or 9 titles that they put out consistently, top-level talent.
Yes.
Professionally written, professionally drawn. If you like what they're selling, the consistency is well branded. It doesn't drive the retailers nuts. They don't do a lot of gimmicks, and they come out on time, month after month. And they're quietly putting together a very good product there. And I just read the new EXO Manowar book.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous artwork, you know, like really solid, sort of reminiscent of the old heavy metal, you know, sort of fantasy stuff.
Yes, very much so. No, good comparison.
And I know that they're incubating a media strategy there, but they're not like hyping it up until there's something to talk about.
Yeah, until there's something ready. No, I agree with that.
Very, very, very smart people running that company. They're one to watch.
Well, and again, they're hiring talented, creative people from editorial down to the writers, artists, and letterers and colorists. They're really top notch people. Lemire and I think Matt Kent are writing incredible things. Van Lente's doing a great job. Vendetti, when he was doing Man of War, I don't know who, or EXO Man of War, I don't know who's currently doing it.
Matt Kent is doing the new run.
There you go. You know, I mean, yeah, these are really top notch writers and artists and editors and stuff. And I'm rooting for a Faith movie. I think Faith is a really smart book, and it's thankfully not a good calculation from where the audience, you know, what the audience represents. And good news is they got, you know, Jodie Houser to execute a tremendous book. It's a really good, funny book.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So interesting times, man. I think it's fun to be ringside, and I'm glad to be sitting next to you ringside as we watch all this stuff happen, man. This is you continue to write great stuff. I'm really glad Fortune is interested in the geek
Forbes.
Culture. Or pardon me, sorry about that, man. Oh man, sorry, Steve Forbes. Is he still on it?
I don't know, but
he doesn't. You know, apparently he doesn't sign your check. So there you go. Okay. But no, I'm glad Forbes is interested in the geek culture as much as they are, and that you get to write about that at Forbes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I may have some pretty cool new writing news coming over the summer, so we can be back in touch.
Oh, that's great, man. Yeah, please. No, definitely. I mean, and you know, I don't want to, you know, I was going to ask if a new book might be in the works. I don't know. I mean, it's been a few years since your Comic-Con book.
It has, and yes, there are some new projects coming up. But like Valiant, I will talk about them when the time is right. So, but thanks for having me on, man. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, as we wrap up, but real fast though, what conventions are you going to be at this summer?
Well, I've just been to a whole bunch of them, so I think I'm going to take. I may possibly be at AwesomeCon in DC in June, and then definitely San Diego Comic-Con, and most likely New York. In the fall, I'm doing some work for some clients and things like that, and that gets me to some good shows. But the one I can say for sure, in fact, we just booked our tickets today, is San Diego.
That's excellent, man. I unfortunately may not be at San Diego this year. I did the last 7, and might have to take a break this summer. But regardless, I hope to see you in New York, and as always, stay in touch. And yeah, when your announcements are ready, I hope you'll come back.
Thanks so much, John. Great to be with you.
That's Rob Salkowitz. Remember to follow Rob on Twitter to get instant access on all of his web coverage, whether it's at Forbes or ICV2 or on his own blog. And Rob's Twitter is at Rob Salk, R-O-B-S-A-L-K, at Rob Salk. So it was great talking to Rob, and I look forward to hearing his news that's coming up later this summer. Thanks again for listening to Word Balloon today. It was all brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where the Daredevil by Brubaker and Lark Omnibus Hardcover Volume 1. They have new packaging for this. It is 50% off and just $50. I was talking about the Brubaker and Lark Daredevil run just over the weekend, actually. Crazy. Mighty Avengers by Bendis, the trade paperback complete collection. Let's see, this is Volume 1, or is it just the whole collection? No, it's the whole collection. It's 512 pages. 42% off, $23.19. Damn. Batman and Superman, Volume 6, Universe's Finest. That's from Pete Tomazzi and Robson Rocha, and it's 45% off, $16.49. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey, my buddies Julie and Shauna Benson, and Claire Rowe as the doing the art. The book is 50% off, $8.49. All from InStockTrades.com. Check out all the great details and find great savings at InStockTrades.com. Thanks again, League of Word Balloon listeners, for your support. C2E2 is coming up in a couple weeks. I cannot wait. I have so many interesting interviews already lined up, not from the con, but before the con. In fact, this week, talking to three amazing artists and a film guy. They are going to be great. So really excited to be giving you some incredible coverage this month going into C2E2 and certainly coming out of it. It's going to be a great April, and I'm glad you're here for the ride. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2017.